I too would like to thank the organizers. I'm very happy to be here today. I hope that I can be forgiven for sidestepping the main theme of this conference, that is the categories documentary versus literary papyri. I want to look instead at some different categories, namely those of inscriptions versus papyri. And this dichotomy allows me to collapse the distinction between literature and documents, taking both together as evidence for ancient life in its different dimensions. I've become interested in the subject of Egyptian epigraphy through my work at the Red Sea port of Berenike. Since 2015, some 35 new Greek inscriptions, mostly from the port's central temple, which was dedicated to the goddess Isis, have turned up. The new finds give us a total of some 50 inscriptional texts from the site, though some are rather fragmentary. More than anything, the discovery of the inscriptions has made me more attuned to epigraphic practice in Greco-Roman Egypt, a subject that not always gets much attention, partly because of the different ways that inscriptions and papyri have historically been treated. Most major papyrological resources ignore inscriptional evidence. This applies to the Heidelberger Gesamtverzeichnis, the Duke Data Bank of Documentary Papyri, and the checklist. Exceptions are Trismegistos and, to some extent, the Sammelbuch, although the latter has not been comprehensive. The reason that the Duke Data Bank doesn't incorporate them has something to do, I'd guess, with the awkward marriage and subsequent divorce of PHI and the Data Bank many years ago. While Duke isn't likely to take up inscriptions anytime soon, TM does a great service by at least linking to PHI, and the forthcoming corpus of Ptolemaic inscriptions promises to give better access to Ptolemaic inscriptions, and we might hope for something similar on the Roman front one day. This long-standing divide between epigraphy and papyrology can make it easy to ignore the inscriptional evidence. I might cite an inscription because of parallel onomastics or refer to a dating formula shared by both inscriptions and papyri, but previously I didn't wonder much about how papyri intersect with inscriptions. I'm happy that this conference has given me a chance to look at this intersection. I should state at the outset that I'm not the first to do this. Amin Ben Aissa, for example, devoted some space to the topic in the introduction to his fine edition of Pioxy 5202, a possible copy of an honorific inscription for the poetic victor Apion, which I'll talk about a little bit later. However, I'm not aware of any devoted study of the topic of inscriptions in papyri, nor am I offering it here. Statements about the subject are usually very brief and tucked inside line notes of editions. Having said all this, let me get to the heart of this talk. The basic question I pose is, what do papyri tell us about inscriptions and/or the process of commissioning and/or inscribing them on incisable materials? Whether stone or plaster, bronze, wood, what have you. The last qualification points to the first problem. What we mean by inscriptions can be very vague. In this category, one might include proper stone inscriptions, whether self-standing or not, bronze tablets, graffiti, plaques or plaques in Greek, whatever those may have been. What about wooden tablets? Both inscribed and some inked, such as mummy labels, like this one resembling a stele. For the moment, though, I limit myself primarily to stone inscriptions. Types of inscriptional texts referred to or imitated in papyri are equally varied and can include funerary inscriptions, both verse and prose, dedications, I leave out pros cunemata, ordinances, honorific decrees. But from this, don't assume that there are many references to inscriptional texts in papyri. On the contrary, there aren't. I've assembled a list of some 40 examples of texts from the early Ptolemaic to the 6th century that seem to represent, quote, or refer to the setting up or publishing of inscriptional texts. In many cases, however, it's not clear exactly what form the actual inscription referred to would have taken, whether it was in stone or bronze or whatever, or even whether the papyrus itself could be hung up as a notice. Nor does it say do they say much about who was responsible for inscribing, that is, for publishing them. I've assembled the papyri that have something to do with inscriptions into three groups, which you can see on this slide. First, I've looked for instances where a papyrus is said, because of its form, that its script or its layout, to look like either a draft or a copy of an inscriptional text, or the inscriptional text itself, that is, the papyrus that might have been hung up for public notice. Deciding this is often a subjective process. Second, I've grouped texts by content, when the actual language of the papyrus, be it a verse text, for example, evokes comparison with inscriptional texts. This too is rather subjective. Finally, in group three, I've confined myself to papyri that, by the context, have something to do with inscribing. For example, a command that might be given for a text to be inscribed and set up in public, or a promise might be made to do this. In group one, these are texts that show the layout and script of an inscription, perhaps. This group is of actually least concern to me at the moment, so I won't say a whole lot about it. Famous examples of the type are, of course, the Paucestus papyrus. The editor suggested it could have been hung out as a notice, or it might have been a model for an inscription. A 5th century tabula ansata may have served as a draft of an inscription or a mummy label. There's also the well-known Latin POC 2950 apostle-bull model of a dedication to Diocletian and Maximian. It too may have been intended itself for display. A dedication made by members of the second Iturian cohort to Zeus Serapis on an ostracon from Mons Claudianus represents a similar case. From outside Egypt, there's the calendar of festivities from Dura, known as the Feriale Diranum, P. Dura 54. Inscriptional examples of such calendars and fasti, of course, survive. But we can't be sure whether the papyrus was a copy or a draft of such an inscription, or is itself meant to be displayed. The reason I don't spend a lot of time on this group is because judgments about whether they were copies or public notices in their own right can never be confirmed or denied. Moreover, and this is perhaps more significant, we find in them absolutely no information about the circumstances surrounding their creation and or dissemination. In group two, we have papyri that seem to be inscriptional in content, that is to say, the texts display the language of inscriptions, even if the format doesn't. A good example of this group is the famous papyrus with the two epitaphs of Zenon's dog, Tauron, one elegiac and the other iambic. As is well known, the poor dog was apparently killed by a wild boar while protecting his master, Zenon. The epigrams were sent by Apollonius to Zenon in the Fayum, and perhaps they were commissioned in Alexandria, but who knows? Were they intended as an actual stone inscription, or were they pure literary exercises? This is something we can argue about until the cows come home, but I don't think we can say for sure. We face a similar case with P. Homburg 122, a 5th, 6th century hexametric poem that's said to be the text of a stele. The papyrus is related to a cursed text in the Uppsala collection. Did the Homburg epitaph adorn a real stele? It certainly could have. an epitaph for a 29-year-old man named Anubion, published in Piros Gerig. It's 114, fits this category too. Zeratelli speculated that the tablet itself was a substitute for a real stone inscription. I don't have a photo of the object, but I can show this funerary inscription in wood. The Ross Georg one refers to a tablet being set up. This funerary inscription contains a common epitaphic line. A final example of group two papyrus text is Pioxy 795202, which I mistyped. It's 5202, not 5303. It details the honors and privileges granted Appion, son of Posidonius, the well-known Alexandrian scholar, for his victories in a range of poetic contests. These included a double victory in the circuit-crowned games and success in competition at Argos, Syracuse, and Naples. Amin Benaisi argues persuasively that the text is a copy as opposed to a draft of the inscriptional text because of apparent copying errors and features such as line fillers. The original inscription was set up by Appion's Patris, a Greek city, perhaps Alexandria. The text is no doubt exceedingly interesting by itself, but it lacks the context, which leaves a lot of questions open. Not only the question, where was the actual inscription set up, but why did a copy of it end up on a papyrus in Oxyrhynchus? Did someone who was interested in Appion's life, for instance, an ancient historian or a biographer, acquire a copy of it? To what extent does the papyrus allow us to speak of the reception and circulation of inscriptional texts? This meta-information, for a lack of a better term, that might answer such questions is lost. We have only a verbatim copy of an inscriptional text preserved on a papyrus. Where we do find contextual information about the inscriptional text is in my group three. These are papyri that order or refer to the publication or promulgation of decrees, proclamations, orders, honors, etc., sometimes including copies of the very document that is to be set on display. I say set out, often Greek ektithemi or protithemi, and not inscribed because the papyri usually do not make it clear whether the thing to be set out in public was a stele, a wooden or bronze tablet, or a papyrus. Greek words such as stele, tabla, deltos, and plax are ambiguous when it comes to material. They can refer to bronze or stone, or even wood in some cases, and are seldom precisely defined. Rare exceptions, however, exist. A very interesting one is the letter of the Emperor Gordian III from 241-42, edited by Peter van Minnen and Siska Hogendijk. It concerns tax exemptions that citizens of Antinoopolis were supposed to enjoy on goods imported from Upper Egypt. These exemptions had been declared 100 years earlier by the Emperor Hadrian. In Gordian's letter, the emperor reaffirms the privileges granted by Hadrian, which had apparently been inscribed on a stele that was destroyed. Gordian writes to the Antinoites, "You have the power to set up the stele that was taken down, as long as a faithful copy of it is preserved on the basis of the duplicate stele kept at Memphis." So there was at least one inscriptional copy of this inscription in circulation. And this inscriptional copy retained relevance and authority even 100 years after its first incising. Interestingly, textual authority lies, in this case, in the inscriptional copy at Memphis, and not with, for example, an archived papyrus. He doesn't say check your archives in your papyri for a text. As evident from this example, descriptions and papyri of epigraphic practice bring greater dynamic to the more static and contextless texts of groups 1 and 2. But here too, there are limits to what we can learn from papyri. For example, the most common type of group 3 texts are those that deal with official ordinances, proclamations, or decrees, prostagmata, programmata, diatagmata, or the like, which are supposed to be made public by being set out or published in the metropoles and the most conspicuous parts of the nomes. This could apply to a decree of a dioiketes from the mid-second century, as in the first text, or to the proclamation of a prefect in the mid-third century, as in the second text on this slide. Most of these papyri do not say what epigraphic form the text would take, but inscriptions such as the well-known decree of the prefect Tiberius Julius Alexander from the year 68, which was left on the northern gate of the Temple of Hippus in the Karga Oasis, gives some idea of how a prefix edict might have looked when it was published in the metropolis in most conspicuous parts of the nome. This particular inscription covers a wide range of issues, which the prefect says had been raised by the many petitioners who appealed to him after he took office. These issues included compulsory services, the unlawful detention of debtors, and the abuses of prosecutors. While it does not seem to have been directly related to temple matters, the temple provided exactly the kind of conspicuous, monumentalizing place that was needed to disseminate the message as widely as possible. When we find an edict monumentalized, so to speak, on something like the Hippus inscription, an edict reported in a papyrus acquires a new dimension. We see its potential to become a very public witness to royal or imperial authority. What we often lack, though, is a procedural statement about how the text of the papyrus was transformed into text on stone or some other material. The closest we get to this is a papyrus from the third quarter of the second century BC. In it, the superintendents of the precincts of Arsinoe Philadelphus at Oxyrrhynchus in the Fayum complained to the acting strategos about aggressions they've endured. They say that they already went to Alexandria and submitted a petition to the king and queen, but no one has heeded the royal order they received, which demanded the aggression stop. As a last resort, they asked that a copy of the royal ordinance be inscribed on the outside of the gate of the precinct below an existing tablet or plaques. Presumably, there was something written already on the gate about the right of asylum, perhaps a prohibition against unlawful entry. The new inscription was meant to reinforce this. In his edition of the papyrus, Arthur Hunt cites as a parallel the asylum notice described in I. Pros. 33, one of two copies of an inscription from Theadelphia dating to the early first century BC. It describes how stone inscriptions are to be placed at 50 paces apart in the direction of the four winds, telling unauthorized people to stay out, don't enter if you have no business here. One thinks perhaps again of the famous order of Palcestis. Interestingly, however, it's not a simple one-sentence command that was inscribed on the stele at Theadelphia. It was the entire petition. I've spoken mainly about the promulgation or publication of decrees and ordinances or other official commands that local officials sought to publicize, often in inscriptional form. References in papyri to dedications are even rarer than these. At any rate, they fly under the radar of our documentation. There is no formalized language if we exclude proscunemata, as there is with ordinances and decrees. Where papyrus documents state that they should be published in a conspicuous place, that's something we do not get. Nevertheless, there are a couple of clear cases in the papyri where dedications are being dealt with. The first is a papyrus concerned with the Ibis cult at Theadelphia, dating to the mid-2nd century BC. It's a petition filed by priests to the Epimeletes concerning wrongdoing against them, and it ends with a vow to honor the king and his children with a votive offering. The exact wording of the dedication is not given, only the promise, as you see here, to set up at the temple, to set up stele for you and your children. We could imagine something like, Fayum, this lower text, which has a dedication to the king, queen, and children, and is also from the mid-second century. Where we do get papyrus evidence for the exact wording of an inscription is in P. Giessen 99 from the 2nd or early 3rd century AD. It contains a direct quotation of a votive inscription from the year 7978 BC, the second year of Ptolemy the 12th Auletes. The papyrus preserves acts of a cult association made up of Apollo worshippers from Idumea. The speaker, probably an advocate, criticizes the cult association for their non-Egyptian, that is, non-Greek and Egyptian, rites and for their foreign language. To strengthen his critique, he orders that copies of the two inscriptions standing in front of the temple be read aloud, and taking copies of the two stele, read them for me. On behalf of King Ptolemy and Queen Cleopatra, who is also Tryphena, the father-loving and brother-loving gods, the Apolloniatae mercenaries on guard at Hermopolis, dedicated to Apollo and the divine guardians of the hearth, the shrine and altar and enclosing wall and appurtenances. This is an extremely interesting text that gets even more interesting when we see that copies of the dedication are preserved on stone at Hermopolis. The inscriptions consist of the dedication and the names of all the soldiers. The Giessen papyrus is what provides context for these inscriptions. In particular, it reveals the biases of people like the advocate who objected to the presence of foreign cults in Egypt, and it shows that people could engage with inscriptional texts several hundred years after the inscriptions were set up. The stones retained relevance for a long time. Factoring in the case of the Giessen papyrus into later culture wars. Seeing this example makes me view inscriptions such as this as the two late 2nd, early 3rd century steles set up at Berenike by Palmyrene troops in a different light. Here is the bilingual stele that Berechiah, the sculptor, dedicated to the Aramean god Hierubal in Berenike. The first two lines preserve a Palmyrene text and the rest is in Greek. Viewed against the more or less contemporary Giessen papyrus, one might wonder about the broader cultural context in which foreigners such as the Palmyrenes were setting up cults in the 3rd century, but I won't go into that now. To sum up, I've tried to show this morning a range of papyrological attestations for inscriptional, both verse and prose, habits. All of them can lead one to speculate about inscriptional practice in Egypt. However, papyri that contextualize inscriptions, the examples in my group 3, offer some distance from which we can observe how people engaged with inscriptional texts, quoting them to support personal biases, referring to them, as in the letter of Gordian, for authority. By recognizing the authority that the inscriptions were imbued with, we get a better idea of how important it was to the ancients to publish or publicize information on a monumental scale by making it available in conspicuous places in cities and villages, as the papyri not infrequently call for. Thank you.